Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey folks, Ben here. This is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Welcome along. Thanks for joining me. I hope you're good. Thanks for all your positive feedback, which is very welcome and a great encouragement. Do keep it coming if you're so inclined. Thanks if you left a review on iTunes. Special thanks to my token hater, who of course won't be listening, but left a typically bonkers one-star review, which I feel is an important rite of passage, really, for anybody putting something out into the world via the old internet. So thank you for putting me among such good company, and I hope you can find a way to address all that resentment and bitterness and disappointment that is eating you up inside before it causes too much damage to your soul. It's hard, I know, I really understand, I honestly do. This week my guest is the awesome Juno Calypso. If you've been living under a rock or have recently awoken sleeping beauty-like from a long coma, nice to have you with us again, and you have failed to catch Juno's work either online or in print, you can check it out at junocalypso.com whilst you listen to our chat. I'll introduce her properly in a minute, but first let's have a couple of bits of photo business. Congratulations to former guest Laura Panak and to David Ryle for winning the 2016 Getty Image Prestige Grants to help them pursue dream projects. Laura won a $15,000 award for her project Youth Without Age and Life Without Death, which through symbolism will explore mortality and immortality. That is a project that she was in the early stages of when I spoke to her last year, and she was trying to figure out how to go about doing it. So it'd be great to see that come to fruition. David received $7,500 to pursue his project Borderland, which examines the physical, cultural and historical significance of national borders throughout Europe. A shortlist of 18 photographers has been announced for the New East Photo Prize to find outstanding photo stories from the post-Soviet world, the Balkans and the former socialist states of Central and Eastern Europe. 10 finalists will be selected this week, I think, from the 18, all of whom will feature in a group show at the Calvert 22 Foundation in London. You can see that shortlist at calvertjournal.com. The link is right there on the homepage, you can't miss it. Finally, I was going to let you know about a recently launched Kickstarter campaign by another former Small Voice guest, the inimitable Mimi Malika, to fund his forthcoming photo book about his native Sicily, Terra Nostra, which will be published by Dowie Lewis. However, no need really, because the project was fully funded within 2 or 3 days of launch. It's currently around a 150% mark, I think. So, congratulations to Mimi for running an exemplary Kickstarter campaign. Even so, if you want to take advantage of any of the special deals on offer, including a discounted price for a signed copy of the book, you can still go ahead and pledge. Go to Kickstarter.com, type in Mimi Malika or Terra Nostra, it'll pop right up. So my guest, Juno Calypso, is a 2012 graduate of the BA Photography degree course at London College of Communication, where her final show was awarded both the Hot Shoe Portfolio Award and the Michael Wilson Photographic Prize. In 2013, The Independent noted Juno Calypso as one to watch, as have numerous other publications since. The Catlin Art Guide featured Juno as one of 40 of the most promising new artists in the UK, subsequently shortlisting her for the 2013 Catlin Art Prize, where she won the Visitor Vote Prize. In 2015, she also won the BJP International Photography Award. Her work is featured in the current issue of Foam magazine as one of 24 young artists shaping the future of photography. Juno has exhibited internationally with group shows in London, Miami and New York, and her work has been featured in the Sunday Times magazine, Wonderland, Dazed and Confused and the Huffington Post, among many others. Let me, by way of an intro, read a brief artist statement by Juno. I recently began working with self-portraiture, which led to the creation of a character named Joyce. Within elaborately staged large format photographs, I draw upon personal experience to perform critical studies into modern rituals of beauty and seduction. Objects once perceived as radical, innovative, fun and nutritious, an electronic anti-wrinkle mask, computer equipment from the 1980s, baby oil, a tin of cold meat, have become joyless and oppressive. Joyce appears alone, consumed by artifice, her glazed appearance acting as a mirror to the exhaustion felt whilst bearing the dead weight of constructed femininity. So here to shed more light on all that and expand upon it is Juno Calypso. Yeah, so you survived your drunken...
I have survived.
Fall, yes. Which we won't dwell on. I don't even know why even bring it up.
No, please do.
Because that's not much of an intro, is it?
No, it's a great intro. I think everyone should start out with what was your embarrassing highlight of the week?
Yeah.
And okay. That was mine.
Yeah, you had a little tumble.
Yeah.
At the Frieze Art Fair in front of important people.
Loads of important people.
Or rich people.
And do you know what they said when I fell over?
What?
No one came to help me. They just said, you're not even wearing heels.
So, what does that say about the kind of people there then? That they're not the most humanitarian and compassionate characters.
I think
it's just like, no, this dude, is just, you're not even wearing heels.
Yeah.
Like, what excuse have you got?
Exactly.
My God.
I know.
You've got to be careful. My sister did that and had a glass of wine in her hand at the time, and she did
smashed
actually.
Smashed her face.
Yeah, she smashed her face.
That's
yeah.
a nasty one.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. No, I just smashed my reputation. That's fine.
Yeah. But you weren't selling work there or anything? Or
no, nothing at all. I was just there.
Ligging about.
Yeah.
Okay.
For the drinks.
Right, nice. Well, but, I think I think that is probably the best reason to go to any of those things, right?
Yeah, well, that's how I feel like I got into everything. Just by showing up to everything, being there and being drunk and being like, who's that annoying girl? Oh, okay, she's in this magazine now. Okay. They correlate the two and they're like, okay, I see. So I think just turn up to everything and show your face.
Yeah, and be a presence.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you got quite a huge sort of social media following compared to a lot of people. And, you know, maybe that's because of you're of that generation. And, you know, I always think that you've got some kind of secret that you don't tell us.
A secret.
You don't tell
us. How to get followers.
Old gits.
How to get 10,000 followers in one day.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
You know, lots of. But I guess it's just because you've had a lot of press for the work that you've done.
People ask me this a lot. They're like, why do people love publishing your pictures? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, that's quite an awkward question to ask someone. Like, why does everyone like what you're doing?
Yeah.
So
how are you supposed to answer that?
They answer it for me. They're like, well, I guess your pictures, you know, they make really good spreads in magazines. So that's why you're getting publicity. And it's like, why can't we all just say, like, well done, you took a great picture?
Yeah.
But they're like, maybe it's because they're colourful that they like publishing them. And maybe it's because of they're trying to, like, find the science behind why my pictures are popular. But I think...
But they sound like...
They just look nice, guys. Like, come on.
Yeah. It's a little more to it than that, which I'm sure we're going to get into.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that sounds like those are kind of resentful, embittered people who wish that their pictures were in the magazine.
Or, maybe. Who knows? But also just, like, they don't want to just... admit to just something being they don't want to just make it simple, they want to make it complicated and use complicated words instead of just saying this, she just did a good thing.
Exactly.
People like it.
It's interesting.
It's popular.
It is. I mean, that's a good point. You know, what sparks people's imagination, what captures you know, picture editors attention. And I guess what it is originality. One of the things and I would say and that's what you are bringing, I would say. But anyway, we'll get on to all that. How'd you get a rock and roll name like Juno Calypso? you'd have to become an artist or a pop star or something.
Well, one of them isn't real. Can you guess which one?
Oh. Juno.
No! That's the real one. Calypso is the fake one.
Okay.
Yeah, 50-50. So my real name is Juno.
Okay.
My last name is a Maltese name.
Yeah. So your dad's Maltese.
My dad's Maltese.
Okay.
No one can pronounce it. No one can spell it. And when I was in my last year at uni, we had a careers teacher called Dallas and from America. And he was like, one more thing. He was like, if you have a weird name, change it now. Like, do not, like, no one will, if they can't Google you, you're not going to have a career. So... I did.
Brilliant. So that is quite interesting that you had sort of, you know, enough kind of foresight and sort of, I don't know, you were considered enough to do something like that, because it does imply that you've got some smarts, as it were, in terms of how to become a brand, as it were.
I was branding myself. I was. Yeah, I did.
Yeah. And you know, yeah, increasingly that's become part of the landscape.
I mean, I guess it sounds like no one wants to admit stuff like that, like, oh, branding, but yeah, it works.
So you grew up in London?
I did. I was born in this house that you're in right now. I think I was born in this room.
Were you?
That we're in right now.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Really?
And so was my brother. I think he was born upstairs.
Wow.
Because my parents are doctors, so they're like, we've got this. We don't need to go to Homerton.
Okay.
We're good.
Awesome.
So yeah.
So they're both doctors?
Yeah.
What are they, GPs or?
Mum's a GP.
Yeah.
Dad's a skin doctor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was thinking, oh, you must have had quite a sort of artistic, creative upbringing, you know, with sort of, I don't know, I had this imagination.
Tell me what you imagined. I really want to know.
Yeah, imagine you had
this little calypso, like, running around in.
Sort of bohemian, very kind of, you know, artistic, creative parents, kind of children of the 60s or 70s maybe.
Yeah, ish. No, definitely, like, if you look around, you know, I'm not in a clinic right now. There is creative stuff in there. Yeah. My mum paints. My dad had a dark room and like still does like photography stuff now. But they were both pushed into being doctors because their family were like, you must be the doctor of the family.
Right.
And so they just put their hobbies to the side. And then me and my brother just came out completely creative. So my brother's a musician and I'm, I don't know, photographer or whatever. Okay. And so, yeah, we have to do it full time.
Yeah.
And
so, yeah, you probably inherited the creative genes, even though your parents, you know, like you say, went into sensible professions. Mm-hmm. What kind of influence did your mum have on you?
I can talk all day about that. She's just the kind of person who has no time for anything. Like when I was growing up, I was like, mum, like, can we like build a den? Mum, like, can we go do this? Do you want to go to, like, do you want to do this? Anything. She's like, no. I'm busy. Like she was just always busy.
Right.
Like she would work full time. She's like the longest serving GP in Tower Hamlets, works like a bazillion hours a week. And then on the side, she was like learning to speak Bangladeshi so she could communicate with her patients more and like doing a PhD in anthropology on Bangladeshi families in East London just to be more clever, like just be like, oh, let me just add more knowledge to my head.
Yeah.
So she is like embarrassing to live with because you can't live up to her standards.
Right.
She's just a superwoman.
Right.
So even though she doesn't take pictures or do that kind of stuff, just her work ethic is like disgusting.
Mm.
Yeah.
But that sounds like you might have ended up kind of quite, you know, that might have been a problem that she was that, you know, if you've got a parent with very high expectations.
Yeah.
But you seem like, you know, I mean, I don't know, obviously, but you seem to have come out really quite well.
I hope so,
and
thanks.
You've got, yeah.
Yeah.
You've clearly got a work ethic in the way that you produce your pictures, which, you know, we can kind of get onto.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of kind of the way in which she influenced you as a feminist was you. I think you described it as a brutal education. What did you mean by that?
Jesus Christ. Okay, right. I can tell you something. So I never heard the word feminism ever in my house. Like it wasn't like, hi, we're going to teach you to be a feminist now. Men are rubbish. Ha ha. Like that's literally what people imagine a feminist mum is doing. She would just keep it real. Like she would do things like, I don't even know if it was a feminist upbringing, but like I would make, once I was making like a little doll out of stuffing and like whatever, like pins and needles, like, oh, I'm making a little doll. And I was like, mum, look, like, look at my doll I made. And I was only like 7 or something. And she just looked at it and she was like, it looks like an abortion. And I was just, and obviously I didn't understand what was going on, but things like that would go into your head where she was just not hiding anything from you.
Yeah.
So if there was something on TV about sexual assault, she would just tell you exactly what it was and you'd be like, oh. So she just didn't hide the facts. She was just telling you like what the world is like.
Mm.
And so,
yeah, so it was kind
there was no choice whether to become a feminist or not. After that, you were like, okay, I'm 7 and I get it.
It was innate.
Yeah.
But she didn't kind of give it a name.
She was just like, the world is fucked, by the way. Like, that was it.
Sounds like a fascinating character, your mum.
She is.
So yeah, you're saying that, you know, you had 2 decades of taking pictures of yourself before it became a serious thing. So how did that start then? You were a kid at the time.
Yeah.
What, how did that begin? Do you remember the origins of that?
Yeah, because I made like a little timeline. I tried to find all the pictures that I'd ever taken of myself and put them together. And so the earliest one I could find, I think I was 7, using just like the family snapshot camera in the mirror. That was that one. And then when I was 8, I got a Game Boy camera and I started using that. So it was just, I was born in 89, so I just had cameras around.
Yeah.
So it was just, as they progressed, I progressed.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, being digital cameras, it means...
Yeah.
You know, you're of a generation where, you know, you're seeing the picture straight away, so you get to...
And also it's private. I just realised
that
first picture on the family camera, I couldn't just go to Snappy Snaps by myself. I didn't have money. And so you would have to go through your family and that just kind of censors everything.
Right.
So digital, you can get wild by yourself.
Do whatever
no
you
one
want.
No will know.
Yeah.
Exactly. You can delete.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so when did it start to become a bit more serious then?
Like what I always say is, it only got serious when I was at uni. Like that was it. That was the moment. But I think when I was in sixth form, that's when it got a bit more serious. But my teacher hated it, so I never really talk about that time because it's not like, yeah, I had a great breakthrough and everyone loved it. It was more like the first time I studied photography was in sixth form. That was like the first time it was available as a course. And I was like 16, 17. And then obviously I had to take it seriously because I had to get a grade, but I didn't get a good grade. I got a C because I still wasn't using myself a bit, but I would. And then I don't know, they just really didn't like what I was doing.
Mm. They didn't like the fact that you were focusing on yourself.
No, I wasn't really using myself much. What I was doing is I was using myself a bit and using other people, but I wasn't very subtle. I was doing a lot of stuff with like violence and horror and blood. And they were like, you can't do this. This is like, I think I took a picture of my friend's brother who was like 4 and we gave him a black eye and a nosebleed with like jam. And she was like literally about to report me to the NSPCC. She was like, this is disgusting. I know people that would be disgusted with you. Like, and so
really,
that's when I tried to take it seriously. And then I was like, right, I hate photography. I'm not going to do it ever again.
Oh man, it just goes to show how, you know, teachers can have such a negative influence as well as a positive one. Thank God there are good ones who kind of get it. Because, you know, what were you, 16?
17.
So like,
you know what I mean? That could have been a cry for help. I could have been like, that bruise represents my childhood. Like, you know what I mean? Like, she just instantly took it as, oh, this.
She brought her own shit to it, basically. And
But.
So that could have put you off.
Do you know what? It didn't. I like it when people don't like my work, because then I'm like, right. I'm going to come back and prove you wrong.
Yeah, exactly. That's interesting.
But no, I think when I started taking the self-portraits really seriously was that second year at uni where I was at LCC and every week you had to bring in a new bit of work and I didn't have anything to show.
Mm.
And so I brought in all these like silly little tests that I've been doing with myself and everyone was really serious in my class. Like, everyone was like, this is a serious time. And they all just started laughing. I was like, this is it. This is what I want to do. I want to make people laugh.
Mm. Okay,
right. Because there didn't seem to be a lot of humor in photography.
Yeah.
Maybe I was just being like adamant that there wasn't and I was the only person doing it, but it didn't feel like there was a lot of comedy around.
Yeah. But the fact that you'd already chosen to do photography as a degree, you know, kind of indicates that you were already serious enough that that's what you wanted to study.
Kind of.
Or was it just like, oh, it's got...
No, it was. So I had the bad time at sixth form where they were like, you're disgusting, you're a disgrace to photography. Here's a C, go away. And then I did an art foundation and I like tried so hard to get onto the fine art course because I thought that's where they let you be disgusting. That's where you can be stupid and irresponsible and whatever. But then... because I only did like photorealistic paintings, so I'd take a picture and paint from it. They were like, you need to be spoon-fed ideas. You're a moron. You'll never be an original artist. You belong in the media department, and that's where we're going to put you in for. And they signed me up.
More very influential, very more.
Yeah,
more sort of,
I'm telling you, no one liked my work until about 4 years ago. No one liked me for so long.
Wow.
That's why I'm enjoying this popularity, because literally they were like, we hate you. And then even when they put me in the media department in my art foundation, I did one good picture and they were like, okay, cool, yeah you can stay. And then for my final my final like art foundation show piece, I came in on the night with all my friends to be like, oh, come and have a look at my work, and it just wasn't there. And I was like, where is it? And they were like, yeah, we just didn't like it, so we didn't put it up. And so I was just like, no one was on my side for a long time.
Well, you know, where do you get this the fortitude from that makes
fortitude,
you know, sort of
like
strength,
a fort,
the strength,
like a literal fort?
Yeah, exactly.
Like I'm a wall.
Yeah. Where do you get that sort of strength to say, you know, well, fuck everyone, I'm going to keep doing it? Because that maybe that comes from your mum.
Yeah, I think it comes from my mum, and I think it comes from just growing up, how I did, where I did. Like, I don't know. I've always had an attitude at school where I've just been like, I've always bunked off, I've always got in trouble, and there's just always been a part of me that's so arrogant that I don't care. Like when I see authority, like a teacher just being like, yeah, you've missed, like when they just get so stressed, you've missed all these lessons and you've done all this, and I just, part of me is just like, I don't care. Like, I really don't care. I just don't care.
Yeah.
Like, I care about my work and I care about being successful in life, but when someone tries to just put rules on me about like, you need to be here on this time and do that, and it's just like, part of me just goes just starts laughing inside.
Yeah. And I think there's a, you know, long tradition of that in, you know, among artists, that, you know, you just do what you want to do and fuck everyone, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
a lot of
famous artists probably took that view, and you know, also had a lot of rejection and all that.
You got to balance it. You can't fuck everyone, but you some people need it.
Yeah, but in terms of you've got to carry on doing the thing that you're enjoying.
You can just tell they're just being a hater. They're just hating on you. They're not giving you constructive criticism.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, did you start discovering photographers who, you know, sort of became influential at university? Or at LCC doing your degree?
It kind of switched over. So before, the photographers I liked were people like David LaChapelle, like anyone that did colourful, fun things, or even Gregory Crudson I knew a little bit about, but anyone that was just doing something colourful, fun, like Ellen von Unworth, all those people, that was my thing. And then when I went to LCC, that's when they were like, these references are kind of stupid. You should use some really clever ones. And then I started...
Because they were all quite commercial people.
Yeah. LCC really changed me in that way, like, where they were just like, you need to be deadly serious about this. And so that's when I got introduced to people like... I don't know. I'm bad with names. I haven't got like a whole list of people, but just...
Well,
fine
I'm just
art
thinking...
photographers rather than commercial photographers. People that were like, this is a project, not a shoot. Mm. This is a research thing. Mm. Like people that read a book and take a picture as well.
Yeah. So, you know, Cindy Sherman and all those, you know, people.
I knew about her.
You knew about her.
Yeah,
she must have.
That was like GCSE level.
Right, right.
Yeah, they told us about her.
Right. Let's talk about Joyce a bit.
Go on, then. And make me cringe.
Joyce is the character that you have invented for people who haven't seen your work. I think there's 7 people who haven't seen your work
in the
world. No, but people who are listening to this will be familiar with it. And if they haven't, they should go to your website and have a look while they're listening. But you created a character called Joyce. Oh, what was I going to say? Shit.
Great. Yeah. Nothing. Do you want me to tell you about Joyce?
Yeah.
What's the question that hasn't been asked about?
Oh, I know what I was going to say. I was going to say, do you get sick of talking about her at this stage? Or do you think there'll come a stage when you'll get sick of talking about her?
Not sick, because that's so rude. Like, I'm sick of it. Like, but
weary.
I'm cringing. I feel like I invented something that... It's like someone bringing out your old clothes that you wore like 5 years ago. You're like, okay, yep, thank you. Like, but what can I do? I mean, I can't... You know,
I mean, she's still a fresh thing because you're not.
I think it's just saying she. I think that's what it is. It's when it's just like she, like, is yeah. But I mean, how else can you talk about it?
Exactly.
It makes it easier. I've created something that made it easier for everyone to understand it, so I can't disqualify it. Mm. It's got people hooked, but I don't like it.
Mm. Okay.
It makes me cringe. Yeah. But it's fine. Let's talk about her.
Yeah.
Let's go for it. Let's cringe me out.
Where did the idea of creating a character come from?
So that shoot I was talking about in second year, where I brought in all the pictures of myself. Looking goofy. That wasn't supposed to be pictures of me. That was supposed to be pictures of models, friends, hot girls, you know, the kind of girls you put in front of a camera. I was going to have them dressed up in different Anne Summers outfits, like air stewardess, waitress, or like whatever, like all the classic cliche outfits. But I was going to have them looking really bored and pissed off. And then I used me instead. And then that's how the character was made. But that wasn't in my head. I wasn't thinking character. It was only when the project went along and everyone was like, who is this then? Give her a name. Like, what is this? Come, like, what's her? Like, they just wanted me to fill it out a bit more.
Yeah.
And I was like, and having an audience of just my class and my friends, I was like, yeah, sure, Joyce, haha, like, inside joke. Now it's a very public joke.
Why Joyce though? Why that name?
Okay, well, truthfully, I stole it from Edward Scissorhands. You know, have you ever seen it?
Yeah.
You know, is it Kathy? No, it's not Kathy. I don't know. But the one with the red hair and the long nails, and she tries to seduce him in her salon, and she like tries to have sex with him, and he's like, oh.
Yeah.
Her.
That was her.
She's called Joyce.
Okay, right. Cool.
And she was the initial inspiration behind the big hair and all that.
Awesome.
And I think also I just like the name because it's joyful, and she's not very joyful.
Yeah.
She's a bit.
Yeah, and also there's this whole thing of, you know, when is she, you know, what era are we in kind of thing. That's
any era you like.
Yeah, it's kind of deliberately unclear.
Pick and choose.
Is that how you intended it?
My least favourite thing, I hate when people are like, oh, I love your 60s project. And I'm like,
why them?
No, it's not that.
There's like 80s computers.
Yeah, there's just everything. I want everything in it. I don't like...
But that's nice, right? That people are a
time warp.
Unsure.
And, yeah.
Like, or that, you know, that someone might say 60s and then someone just...
Yeah, that's what I like. People are like dead set and they're like, I love that 60s thing you did. And this other person's like, I love that 80s thing you did. And you're like, you're all wrong, you're all right, but it's fine. But yeah, it's a time warp. And it also allows me to be like more messy because then you don't have to be like continuity and all of that. You don't have to be researching.
You're not wedded to any particular...
Exactly. Can you imagine?
So when you sat her down in front, you know, behind all these desks and put her in different outfits, what was the kind of intention behind that? What were you trying to get at, as it were?
Just to make a really simple visual pun.
Right.
It was just, look at this kind of like hot scenario, like look at this cliche scenario of this hot woman or whatever, but her face is really bored. That's it. And also the face is not only bored, but it's kind of an exaggeration of the kind of faces you see women told to pose in. So your mouth is a little bit open and your eyes are a bit droopy, like, you know, when you see a fashion shoot and they're
slightly
scowling and pouting. So I was kind of taking the piss out of that, like exaggerating it to the point of absurdity.
Right. You know, how did these themes that you decided to explore emerge for you? Were they ones that you were always sort of preoccupied by?
Yeah, definitely.
Right. Okay. As a result of what? Experiencing some of those issues as a you know, young woman growing up in this era?
Yeah, 100%. It was completely autobiography. It was completely like method acting my life, 100%. Yeah, just growing up and going through. I think I went through a lot of weird kind of phases, not personally, I mean in society. There was a lot of weird, the way it changed. Like, so when I was growing up, there was no talk, there was no kind of criticism of, well, there probably was, but I just didn't know about the books. But there wasn't a lot of chat about criticism of femininity and criticism of the beauty industry and all those sort of things that were seen as like not real issues. That was like, we're busy tackling the real issues of feminism, but then there's all these surface level issues that were seen as stupid. And then it's not until I feel like the last 5 years that they've become like a real point of convo for a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm curious as to what your experience was.
You want to know what terrible experiences I had as a woman that made me take these crazy pictures?
That's like suggesting I'm some kind of crazy person.
No, I just think you're an interviewer, which is basically another word for a therapist.
No, you can give me some anecdotes if you want.
I can give you some anecdotes.
But I was thinking, yeah, go on then, give me some anecdotes, then I'll follow up with something.
Okay, so not really anecdotes, but I think the thing that I always bring up that kind of legitimizes what I do is just the crazy routines you go through when you're preparing to look nice as a woman. So, and all the kind of crazy bathroom routines and the things you do when you lock yourself away and you're truly alone, but in your mind you're fantasizing and preparing for this situation that probably won't be as good as you imagine. And so that's why a lot of the stuff in my work is to do with beauty and all these beauty routines, but it's also to do with feelings and emotions and like just feeling a bit, feeling hopeful and feeling desire, but then feeling disappointment and then finding the comedy in between those two things.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, that brings up a whole bunch of interesting things. I mean, what I was going to say was, before you kind of open the door, I was just going to say, you know, what was your experience of how your friends felt about these things? And were you typical of women of your generation in, you know, being sort of very aware of these issues? Or were you a bit of an outlier, as it were, among your friends? I mean, obviously, yeah. I'm not asking you to speak for everyone, but just
anecdotally. I think that's a good question, yeah, because it makes it, I can't lie in my answer, I'll tell you the real deal. With my friends, yeah, in secondary school, nothing, like no, there was no like, yeah. I think I had one friend who had hippie parents and she was like, hey, feminism. And then I was like, cool, great. I'm gonna go hang out with these other kids who don't care about anything apart from smoking weed. So yeah, there was like zilch at school.
Yeah, and that would be pretty young to be.
I don't know. I feel like if I'd gone to like some different school or something, I think in different environments, we were just naughty kids. And so there wasn't any time to be like, hey, what are your views? Yeah. Like, do you want to join a debating society? Like, there was no fucking debating society. There was nothing. Yeah. There was just like
smoking weed.
Yeah. And like bunking off. So that's fine. And then I think in sixth form, I had a bunch of friends who were all girls, but they as well, like, just, they're still my friends now. And now they're really switched onto it. But back then it just wasn't a priority.
Of course.
So yeah, I guess I was a bit of a lone ranger, but yeah, I always had like one person that I could chat to about stuff.
Yeah,
but no, I wasn't a part of like, that's what, compared to now, I feel like there's a lot of like girl gangs, like loads of girls together making like zines and doing like slut walks and things together, and I kind of wish I had that when I was younger. It would have been nice.
Yeah, so maybe there's a big
community
more,
now
a bit more awareness, a bit,
it's
younger.
More cool to talk about it now. Yeah.
Yeah, because, and then you think you know, your work basically boils down to two things, desire and disappointment, right? Yeah. I think those are two things. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, we can all talk about that.
Yeah.
Can't we?
We can all talk about desire and disappointment. That's for damn sure, yeah.
It's easy. But it's an easy thing. It's an easy equation. You get excited, you get disappointed. I just think, I don't know, what do I find funny about it? I think it's just because you really trick yourself, you really fool yourself into thinking like something's going to be amazing. And it's funny how you can delude yourself. I think that's what I'm interested in. I love finding out people who are just completely deluded. And I just think, I think it's wonderful. I think it's great. It shows how optimistic we can be. And then when everything crashes down, you're like, oh yeah, I'm just a stupid human. That doesn't mean anything. Of course it didn't work out. Like, the chance, you realize reality is the harsh reality.
Mm. So it's easier not to get too, you know, desirous in
no,
the first place.
No, but then that's the other thing. I've gone through that phase where I'm like, well, I just won't get my hopes up anymore. But then that's so boring.
Yeah.
You have to get your hopes up. Like, you just have to admit that you're going to get excited and you're going to get disappointed. And that's how it's going to be. Like,
and that's just part of life. To
you
kind
can't
of,
be like, no, I'll just be realist about everything now.
Well, then, because then you just become a cynic. I mean, that's what cynicism is,
isn't
it?
Yeah, like no hope for anything.
Yeah.
But I'm very cynical as well. I'm all the things.
You're all the things.
I'm all the things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, but yeah, maybe that's.
And that's why, I guess with my work, I tried to say, oh yeah, it boils down to two things, but that was probably just me in an interview trying to finish the question.
Right.
But
right.
I try and keep, but it's very complex, like all the things that are going on. That's why when people look at my work and they're like, oh, it's about this. It's about 60s women and stuff and the shoes and the high heels and the makeup. And it's like, no, it's about so many things. Like when you're lying on the floor feeling like shit, there's like a lot going through your head. And so that's why I can't really pin one feeling onto the work, but usually it's those two.
Right. But I think in a way that sort of answers the much earlier question about why, you know, the work is been, you know, I'm seen a lot and been used a lot, because it does have all those complex things going on at the same time, and it can be interpreted lots of different ways.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of relatable humor on the internet. I feel like the humor that works best on the internet is things that are relatable. So you know, you see on Twitter that when they're like, oh, when you're feeling like this, or like Monday morning, and there's that's how photography and videos and gifs whatever, I don't know, that's how everything gets used the most, I feel like, with feelings. So when I see my work on the internet, it's always people being like, Monday morning, da da da, or like people just trying to be, you know, people being pissed off about their situation. So that's cool. I like that.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about the humor a lot, and I'm just wondering if you feel that some people just miss the humor in Joyce, because to me, I think it's funny as hell. But yeah. I've heard it described as eerie and sinister and all these things.
It is those things
as well. But yeah, I'm just wondering, you know, are there people who just don't get the humor at all?
Yeah, no, it is funny to sit there. Like, I think I had a meeting recently where someone was just looking at it and they were just like, yeah. Like, just going on and on about like, oh, Jesus, like just talking so theoretical about it. And I'm just thinking, that is not what I was thinking when I made that picture, but sure, like, say, think what you want.
Bring what you want to it.
Yeah, like, that's great. Write that down and put it in a book for me. Write my introduction. But I think they're right, because in the beginning the comedy was so obvious and now it's not. But the right people like you can get that there's dark comedy. So I think I get a lot of that from, you know, like programs like Chris Morris.
Yeah, I mean, that
were you
mentioned
into that
him.
Kind of stuff.
Yeah, totally. And
that
he's
kind of British comedy
dark.
That, yeah, I love that, where if someone turned on, do you remember when he had that program called Jam or Blue Jam,
yeah,
if anyone
whatever.
Turned that on, they would be like, this is hilarious, have you seen that comedy program? They'd be like, this is sinister and fucked up and like I'm gonna have nightmares.
Yeah,
so that's the kind of humor I'm
on. That was right, you know. It's kind of that whole idea of comedy being very dark, taken to
so
the
dark
ultimate.
Where you're like, where's the joke? Like, the baby's made of pipes, like, where's the when do I laugh? Like, that's the kind of comedy I want, where it's like no one's even laughing at it.
But which I think you know, and I think you achieved that brilliantly. Thank, I mean, that kind of hand emerging from the bath, like the creature from the Black Lagoon or something. But I think you've talked about horror films or that being some kind of an influence. Is that
I don't
true?
Watch them.
No.
But they're a massive influence.
Right.
I think I've seen like 4 horror films in my life, but I am inspired by them somehow. I think these days you can just be inspired by film just by Googling the name of the film.
Right.
And Google image.
You can
see some screen grabs. Don't have the nightmares. Just see the images. So that's what I do now. But yeah, I watched something. I can watch 70s ones now. That's all right. But the modern ones, when they're pulling out eyeballs and stuff, I can't watch that.
Oh yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah,
like Saw.
Yeah, that kind of torture porn stuff.
The worst day of my life, my friend at uni made me watch. We were on like a hangover, and she thought the best cure was, you know, you can't move, you're in someone's bed and you're like, you want to go back to your bed but you can't move, and you're in their like dorm or halls, and she made me watch Saw 1 to 5.
Oh my God.
In a row.
That's just masochistic.
It was horrible. Yeah. And I couldn't even sleep.
I wouldn't be able to watch any of that. I hate that. And it makes, like you say, kind of old sort of 70s movies seem very,
it's
kitsch.
Fine. It's like, give me that fake blood. Quaint. That's all good. Yeah.
I think, have you seen Seven? The movie Seven?
No, but that came out when I was a child. And I used to have the TV used to be in here, and I remember they all watched it in here, and I sat in there. So I've heard it. I've heard the film. Haven't seen the visuals.
I always feel that was almost like the first movie that went into that kind of very, very dark.
That's how I watched it as well. Do you remember the Adam and Joe show?
The
way I watched that, because I was too young to watch all this stuff. Like, I remember I was at that age where like the Blair Witch, Seven, and like Hannibal was like the other one. All those crazy films were coming out. But Seven, Adam and Joe did like a parody of it.
Right.
And they had like a guy that had like farted himself to death and stuff. Right. And it was just like, that was amazing for me. So yeah, maybe that's the interpretation I got of Seven.
Right. Yeah. So there's the humor again, you know.
Yeah.
So then what you did with Joyce is The Honeymoon, basically, which is the thing that's kind of, I guess, got the most attention. So when did, I think it's true to say that you kind of start with the location and then the ideas come out of that rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
When did you first discover that as an idea?
Actually, a long time ago, like a couple of years ago. So I went there for the first time in like spring 2015. But I think I found the picture a year before that in 2014 when I wasn't making any work. I was just kind of like lying on my laptop researching, which is the good thing about having creative block these days. You can just Google. Just zip around the internet, not make any work, but you can just resource everything.
Yeah.
Is that right? But yeah, anyway, so I was putting together all these resources in my spare time and I had this folder of dream locations and places, and then I was kind of just deciding where I wanted to go. I think I had this picture of a pink bathroom from TripAdvisor with like mirrors everywhere.
Right.
And I was like, oh, wow, that's amazing. I'll never go there. And then out of curiosity, just dropped it back into Google to find out where it was. And that's when I found out it was in Pennsylvania.
So when you saw this kind of pink heart-shaped bathtub, that must have like lit you up as far as it fitting with Joyce somehow. Or did it not?
Because it was on my computer for about a year, so I don't think it did. I think
I
was depressed. I was blocked. I was in that mood where I was like, that's great, but I'll never go there. Like, whatever. Like, I was just like, cool. Another place, someone else will go. And so I was really pessimistic and really like doubtful of where I was going. But then, you know, that whole idea of like not making work becoming more painful than going and doing something scary. That's the point I got to where I was like, I've had enough. I just need to do it. Like, fuck this. I'd rather be terrified than be sat here for another fucking day, like hypothetically thinking of what to do. So,
well, that's interesting. So you've had that experience of just being completely inert.
I had it for 365 days.
Okay.
I thought artist block was like, oh, it just comes and goes, you know, la la la. A whole year.
Mm.
A whole year. No one told me this would happen. Right. And I, like, but I could talk about that a lot.
Okay, let's do it a bit. I mean, do you think, is it really a thing, or is it just you sort of letting yourself off the hook in the sense that some people have got a real kind of look, you can't wait for an idea to come. You have to have an idea. Yeah. You know, there's that whole thing. But yeah, I think we've all experienced those periods of...
This one was intense. Because normally, like right now, I might be like, oh, I don't know what to do for my next picture. But that's nothing. Yeah. It's like the difference between being like a bit sad and actually clinically depressed. Right. Yeah. So sometimes you might be like, oh, don't know what to do for my next project. Ha, la, la, la. And you might be having fun researching those things. But this was like, it just slowly increased. So I'd be like, I had a really successful year when I graduated. And then it just slowly creeps up on you where you're like making work, but nothing's quite working out. And it's just that you start losing belief. You're like, it's like in other times you'd be like, oh yeah, it's not really working out, but I'll just give it a rest, come back to it tomorrow. But here you start going crazy and you start like doubting everything you're doing. You just kind of almost start self-destructing your whole career.
Right.
And so for a whole year, I was just like, oh, I can't do anything. And I only took one picture that whole year, which was the picture that's in the Eternal Beauty series where like I've got a mask and I'm lying down. And that is the one that's now on the front cover of Phone magazine. So that now when I see that, I'm like, there is the artist block. It was useful.
Right.
Something good came out of that.
Yeah. But you experienced that awful kind of, like you say, that point where it's just so painful not doing anything, that nothing could be worse.
Yeah, after the year, it was, so I had the whole of 2014, I did nothing. That's why when you look through my, if you want to go on my website, look on my CV or whatever, I'm on the about list and there's just a gap.
Mm.
But then 2015, I just was like, I've had enough, I need to do something. And so I just I think I found the name of the hotel, and then 2 weeks later, I was there.
Right. You just, so,
I was like, I'm saved yourself. This. Yeah, I'd have to do it.
But it was quite, I imagine it was quite scary, you know.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the whole plane journey, I was like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Like going crazy. So, yeah.
You are very kind of self-sufficient in a sense. I mean, I'm looking at your pictures, I'm thinking, if ever anyone needed to take a fucking assistant,
yeah, I know.
It's you. And yet you kind of doggedly determined to do it on your own.
Do you know what? I think now, since we're talking about parents, since this is a therapy session and you want all the tea to be spilt, that's where my dad comes into it. Like literally yesterday, like I see my dad a lot and I saw him yesterday and I was like, what is he doing? And because he's a printer. So like I said, he did photography. Now he does printing. And I could just hear him like struggling. And I came in and he had this like 6 foot roll of paper just in one hand, trying to get it into the box, like swinging it around like a snake. Like I was just like, what are you doing? Like, just let me help you. And he didn't even say thank you. He was just like quietly acknowledged that he needed help. Like, and I was just like, oh shit, that's me.
Kind of stubborn self-sufficiency.
Yeah. People, whenever I've done a job where I've done teamwork, people are always like, ask for help, like don't do this on your own. And I'm like, oh, I don't know how. So yeah, I don't like asking for help. But then the
kind of dynamic that creates where you're on your own in these weird locations in itself is part of what
it feeds into. It
feeds into what you end up with.
It wasn't like, I think people imagine that I started the project like this. They imagine that I was like, I'm gonna do a self-sufficient project on my own, no one else, and that's the whole point of it. It wasn't at all. It was just like that first shoot I was supposed to do with the models that got cancelled. And also I was like scared around models. I didn't like being around them. I felt weird directing them, like, do this, do that, open your mouth. Like, what the fuck? Like, what am I saying? I don't want to say that stuff. So I never felt comfortable with models. And then assistants, I'm not very good at teaching people stuff as well. I'm not good at like being like, do this, do that. So it's kind of like, it's a drawback. It's not something I'm proud of. I'm not like, oh, I love being alone. Like, I've made myself proud of it now, but it's because I'm scared I don't know how to work with other people.
Right.
It's not a good thing.
So, you know, you turn
don't
that,
follow me.
Yeah. You turn those things into somehow.
Strengths into weaknesses.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It, no, it no weaknesses help. Into strengths.
Strength. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I turn my weaknesses into strengths.
Yeah. Okay. You ended up, so you turned up in this place in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
How did it all unfold? Because I think you told me you were a travel writer, basically. You had a cover story.
Yeah, I said I was a travel blogger. And yeah, that was I thought, shall I email them before I go? Shall I tell them? And I thought I should, otherwise they'll be like, what are you doing here? So I emailed the marketing guy and I was like this long email, like, oh, I'm doing this thing. And they're just like, yeah, sure. Like, whatever. Do you need anything? Like, can we help you with anything? And so it helped. But then it also made me really scared. The first couple of days I was there, they were like ringing the phone in the room. Like, do you need anything? Can we help you with anything? Can we give you a tour of the hotel? And I was like, oh, fuck.
Right.
Like, this is exactly not what I needed. I need to be left alone to do this stuff. So, yeah, it worked. But it also made me a bit more of a, like, I like to just be under the radar. I want to just slip in and not talk to anyone.
Yeah, of course.
But talking to the people ended up being the thing. That's the most stressful bit for me, not being by myself, but having to just be like, hi, and like just keep the cover up until I get to the room.
Right.
Yeah.
But what it meant was that they gave you free rein in a way.
They
you
did.
Got to experience
got, yeah,
multiple
other rooms.
Rooms. Yeah.
Exactly. Because I did have to pay for the whole thing myself, but I got extra rooms. So
brilliant.
That's
good. So did you chat with any of the couples who were staying there? I'm wondering what kind of interactions you had. Especially as you were on your own.
Yeah, the couples chat to you the least because they're just like, who are you? Like, who are you? Like, we don't want to talk. They start talking to you thinking that your husband's going to turn up and then they realize that you're just by yourself. So the couples, no, I didn't talk to them much at all. But the staff, they were great to chat to because they were so relieved to chat to a single person rather than having to keep looking in two people's eyes and being like, oh, we're so happy. You guys are happy.
Yeah.
Like, they were like finally just a single loner. Like,
they could just talk to you like
a
normal
singular
person.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Instead of kind of, yeah, keeping up the.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah, no.
So let's kind of, I'm fascinated by the process a bit because.
Oh, please. I'll tell you everything.
There's a lot you've got to think about. I mean, you've got to take all these, obviously you've got to take all these props and stuff.
Equipment, props, everything.
And you're shooting, are you shooting on like a big camera or?
No, do you know what? I used to, the first shoot I did abroad in Malta, I took a large format camera with me.
Right.
And like you said, I don't have an assistant. So I just had me and some bubble wrap, and I wrapped the whole camera. I took apart all the different parts, wrapped it up, and wrapped the camera in like lingerie and all the stuff that I was, all the costumes. So it was like the costume department, the film department, the makeup department were all in one suitcase.
Yeah.
And then I was just terrified as well, taking the film through, you know, the x-rays in the airport, all of that.
Mm.
So after that, and then on that same trip, I took a digital camera as well, just to be like, you know, have my back.
Mm.
And I took pictures on film and digital, and I used a mixture of both in the final prints, and no one could tell the difference. People were even pointing at the digital ones and being like, I'm so happy you still use film. It's so amazing, like staying true to the form. And I was thinking, I just put a bit of grain on that in Photoshop.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah.
Okay, that's instructive.
So now I just use a Canon 5D.
Right, okay.
That's my equipment. And a remote control. Because also doing self-portraits, there's no time for expensive mistakes.
No,
like that.
No,
exactly. I can't wait for the film to come back.
Yeah. You've got to nail it.
Yeah.
And so you're sort of, you know, kind of in the tub, you take a couple of frames.
Right.
Put it on a timer.
I'm just going to move that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the remote control I didn't actually get for a few years, and that changed everything, because before I was clicking the thing, you know,
right.
Clicking the shutter, and then it had about 10 seconds to go and pose. So that obviously got boring.
Mm.
Then I found out Canon do this little remote control for like £10 that fits in your pocket. And I was like, okay, changing my life. So that's my tool now. That's more important than the camera.
Yeah.
That is it for me. So now I have the remote control. And yeah, for the ones in the bath, I had the liquids bag for your liquids.
Yeah.
Put the remote control in that. And I'll click it and either shove it under the water or just chuck it to the other side of the room. So because I chuck it to the other side of the room, I have to get out and get it and in and out. And so, yeah.
Right. It's quite a process. So I want to ask you about some of the, you know, some of these themes. The term that I've come across a lot is the labored construction of femininity.
Oh my God, yeah. Do you know why?
Can you just...
Okay.
Clarify what you mean by that.
Well, let me just put it in context. I wrote that when I was at LCC, where they were like, every word must be genius. So I had a very, very clever woman teaching me, Esther Teichman, the photographer. She's very good. She's also very clever. And so you couldn't just write like, oh, I'm taking pictures about being a woman, whatever. You had to like bring out those words like the labored construction of femininity.
Mm.
And now it feels weird to say, because I've said it so many times, I'm like forgotten what I was chatting about.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You know, you, these terms.
What? Labored what? Let's break it down. The labored construction of femininity. So yeah, I guess when I was doing what I was doing, like dressing up in these Anne Summers outfits, I knew what I was doing because I read a few books on feminism, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't really know how to articulate my experience. So stuff like wearing makeup and like wearing sexy clothes for boys, like what does that mean? That wasn't really in the books I was reading. I was reading about like hardcore shit.
Mm.
And then I read this book by Naomi Wolf called The Beauty Myth.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked it up and I was like, whatever, can't be bothered to read this like Cosmo article on like, oh my God, makeup is so bad for women. Like I just thought, ugh, how stupid. Like, and then I read it and I was like, oh my God, like I forgot Naomi Wolf is a genius. Mm. I forgot I'd seen her. She was like on Ali G when I was younger,
yeah,
as like the token feminist. And so, and everyone kind of makes fun of her because they're like, she's like the hot feminist. But that was just right up my street. I was like, she is taking this superficial thing and going deep into it.
Kind of seminal feminist book for you know, people of
your
generation.
It was great. It was like, not only did she take it seriously, she exposed some facts that I was like, this is not superficial. This is everyday, like this is fucked up. So yeah, so I got into that. And that's when I guess I realized that femininity really was a construction.
Mm.
Like all these things that we do are constructed. They're not real. They're not innate. That nothing's natural. And that's another thing my mum always drove home for me. She, like being a doctor and being a feminist, she was like, there's no such thing as natural. She was like, the word natural is just about our morals. There's no like, there's, she was like, if women did things naturally, we'd all be dead because we'd all die at childbirth. So right. Like, I hate people that are like, no, it's not natural. Don't do that because it's not natural. Don't get boob jobs. It's not natural. It's like, nothing's natural. And so femininity is not real. It's a construct.
Mm.
And so the labored construction of femininity is just simply making it, doing it,
right,
constructing it. So like a sculpture, like sitting in your room and laboring over yourself, which, and in that statement, I'm not exactly saying the terrible negative construct of femininity. It just is what it is. And I think that's what my work is. It's not like it's awful. This is terrible. Women should stop. It's more like women do this. We're not going to stop, but let's just analyze it.
Yeah.
Let's just make sure it's all good.
Yeah. There's a lot of masks going on. Yeah. I think what do the masks mean for you?
Two things. Okay, there's like the stupid answer and the clever answer. Which one do you want first?
Both. Give me the stupid one first.
The stupid one is just sometimes I cannot be bothered to look at my face in the picture. Like, you know when you're taking, I mean, I don't know if you take loads of pictures of yourself.
I avoid taking pictures of myself.
Exactly, because you don't want to know some days. No. You don't want
to
know.
Too right. Wait till you get to my age, mate.
I know. I'm red. Like, you're a man. I'm a woman. I'm going to be like crying and getting Botox at the same time.
Well, exactly. I was going to say,
it's going to be worse.
It's worse in a number.
You're like a fine wine. I'm like a ways. Grape drying out to a, what do they dry out into? Raisins. Yeah. I'm going to be a raisin.
Well, that would be the sort of,
I'm up for it. Who knows? In the future, there'll be a raisin revolution. We're all going to love it. We're going to tackle that.
Well, you might very well be,
pioneer of wrinkly women.
Well, your work may well be concerned with that when you get there. But let's
look into the future.
Let's not get 20 years ahead of ourselves.
I know. Let's not start that revolution yet.
The mask.
So half of it's just like, I just can't be bothered to see my face. Like, please, not today. I don't want to know. And then the other half is like, oh, the veil, refusing the gaze. Like, all these things. And also, or maybe the middle thing is what these masks are. They are just pseudoscience, like fake science made up to trick women. Like, they're playing on women's like stereotypical, like the stereotype that women don't know enough about science. So they can be like, this has lights that'll cure your acne and rejuvenate collagen. And they just bamboozle women with fake science.
Yeah, like the shampoo commercials.
All of that.
Aniston's doing the voiceover.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just, they're taking the piss out of women's lives and our bank accounts. And so I'm just trying to throw that back in and take a bit of that. But then also poetically and like metaphorically, it can be like refusing the audience, like refusing people looking at my face. And I remain anonymous. No one knows it's me.
Mm. Yeah, great.
All of the above.
And also plays into that whole kind of slightly creepy vibe, because some of those things, they look like those recovery masks that people who are burn victims have to wear.
Yeah, do you know what?
It reminds me.
I love that. I think having doctor parents, I'm like, I'm all up for the medical stuff. I have to rein it in because people are like, you can't like stop being so medical, because it is a bit cringy sometimes.
Yeah,
it ends up being a little bit like, you know those men that take pictures of women with like amputated legs and stuff. It can get a bit medical fetish. Medical fetish. You don't want to go there.
No. But that brings in an interesting.
Yeah, in a subtle way, I like it. I love the burn masks. I love anything like that. And people now send me loads of like creepy mask things, like Eyes Without a Face, all these films, and Skin We Live In, and all that stuff.
Yeah. And you are interested in some of those things, aren't you?
Yeah, I watch them. When they send me a link, I'll watch
it. I remember a really kind of hokey old sci-fi film from the 70s. I didn't see it in the 70s.
Tell me.
But it was called Who, and it was... It was about this scientist who had a terrible accident or something, and so he had to wear this mask. Mm. So the whole movie is in this mask, and it's probably some kind of corny allegory about identity or proof or knowing stuff. Which, and it's probably something about the Cold War in this as well. But I remember being really quite freaked out by it, because he has this, I don't know, there's something...
I know what it is. I can tell you the answer. Someone told me.
Go on.
I just remembered. The reason we find it scary... And this is also the reason we find women or men with plastic surgery scary, or we end up being like, I don't like people with plastic surgery. Ugh. And it's because we don't like not being able to read someone's emotions. And we also don't like not being able to feel ourselves being reflected back onto us. So we, as humans, we need validation. So I'm looking at you, but I'm looking at you looking at me, and I'm feeling like I'm here, I exist, I'm real, this is real. But if your face was covered up and I couldn't see you, that would all be gone, and I'd be like, oh, I'm not, it's kind of a personal thing.
People
are like, oh, I don't like masks and I don't like plastic surgery because I don't think they should be doing that kind of stuff to themselves. It's not, it's just they're like, I don't like how it makes me feel. It's all personal.
And this is, and that, yeah, kind of puts me in mind of, like you say, there's that picture where you're referencing the veil, because you've got a kind of bridal veil over your face.
Oh, yeah.
which yeah. is all part of the kind of honeymoon
yeah.
thing. But also there is a reference there to the kind of Muslim, yep. you know, tradition.
That, of course, like, and that I love to chat about as well, because it's, that's another thing my mum was very strong on. I think there's a lot of liberal people that think, oh, it's so terrible. Like, oh, they're so oppressed, blah, blah, blah. And it's just, that's them as well making an excuse over the fact that they're just so outraged that they can't see a woman's face. Like,
I was going to say, there is something, but there is...
They feel like, yeah. like you're denying me your face. Let me see yes. your face.
It's,
and
it's kind
like,
of what you said
this
before.
Is my face.
There's
Go
something
away.
Quite alienating about, yeah. about, yeah, not being able to yeah. see that.
Yeah.
Hmm.
We want to be able to have ownership of everything. We want to be like, I want to see everything. Show me your face.
Mm.
So, yeah.
What's with all the meat? That's the other one I wanted to ask.
Is there a lot of meat?
There's a fair bit of meat.
There's a lot of meat, isn't there?
It is referenced quite a lot.
Well, I'm not a vegan.
How did you come by that as a kind of metaphor? Or if
let me
it
think.
Is one?
When was the first meat? When was the first one? I think the first one was that pork luncheon meat. I think I like to relax in supermarkets. I love it. That's my favourite place to relax.
Really?
Not Tesco's or Sainsbury's. Actually, no, I like...
Well, it's got to be Waitrose.
No,
quite
what I mean is, like on holiday.
Right.
I like Lidl. I like Aldi. I like an abroad, a foreign supermarket.
Mm. There's something quite exotic about foreign
yeah.
supermarkets.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Apart from anything else, the food is normally so much
it's
better
all different.
Than the shit that we have.
Yeah, or just, you're just around, you're just in different, there's just different packaging to look at. It's not like, oh, here's the rice or whatever. So yeah, that was in Malta when I was at my grandma's house. Because I go and stay with her, I stay at hers by myself, and there's not much to do when I'm not taking pictures. So I'll be like, should I go to the beach? Nah, I'll just go to the supermarket. So that's my relax time. And I'll just walk around and pick things out. And that was one of them. I don't know, I guess I was just attracted to how, I like things that people turn their nose up at. So I think, I remember when I was at uni once, my favorite food when I was younger was those Frei Bentos meatballs. Mm. You know, the ones in it, it's like meatballs in a tin and tomato sauce. And I just thought they were great. I thought that was normal. I thought that was like normal kids' food. And then when I was at uni, I would eat them as well because comfort, thinking about home, missing home.
Yeah.
And so I was eating them, and this like someone's middle-class hippie mum was like, oh my God, like, do people eat that? And I was just like, yes, I'm eating it right now. Like, if you were eating your fucking kale sandwich, I wouldn't point that out and make you feel bad about it.
Right.
Don't be rude, I'm eating.
Right.
So I was eating my little meatballs, and then I guess it's just, that's like the rebel in me that's like, oh, if you think that's disgusting, well, I'm going to put it on a big picture and stick it in a gallery and stick it in your face.
Yeah, you're sort of rejecting that kind of, that superior, snidey. Which, you know, when you see the kind of pink bathtub room with all the mirrors, the first thing you go is, that is so tacky.
So tacky. Like, oh, like, and I love it. I'm like, yes, why? Why do you not like it?
That appeals to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you included video as well. Mm-hmm. What was your thinking behind that? Is it just because you wanted to throw it in?
No, it's actually just a technical thing. So I, with the camera that I use, you can do video and photo and blah, blah, blah.
5D.
Yeah, that one. And so I have to make these, about a year ago when I was doing the honeymoon thing, or a bit before, no, actually all the way from the start, I've always done videos to help me find the pose. So I don't know what pose I'm going to do. I'm like, I don't have a mirror. I can't see myself. So I thought, let me do a video and then I'll watch the video back, and then whatever looks good on the video, I'll replicate. But then obviously I've ended up with like 5 years of footage of me like prancing around or like just slowly moving in a weird way, like a little puppet. And so I just thought, let me use this for something.
Oh, and I was wondering whether, you know, you've got half an eye on ways to earn a living, because you're not a jobbing photographer in the sense that, unless they want a picture of Juno Calypso, you're not the woman.
I know.
Juno, can you take a picture of Juno Calypso? Yeah, I can do that.
But anything else?
So, as a sort of artist, you have to think of ways to earn a living, you know, outside of the kind of areas that some of us would be looking at. So how are you kind of dealing with that question?
How am I making money?
Well, how are you making money, and what's the master plan?
Well, I who fucking knows? I don't know. I'll take you through my money life. Very briefly.
Your income pie chart.
My income.
As I like to call
it. I love talking about income. I hate when people are like, no, let's talk about income. Basically, the way I funded this whole thing is, in the beginning, I was under the impression that you had to like assist people and la la la. And I literally assisted one person or two people, and that's not my thing. I can't do that. I just, it drove me crazy. And the money's not even that good. They're like, here's £50. Thank you, bye. Yeah. So I assisted, that didn't work. Then I was just like, give me a regular job. And then I worked as a waitress for a long time. I worked in a dry cleaners for a long time. And then I worked as a nanny for a long time. And that was my last job, a nanny. I quit that like 2 years ago. And I was like, then while I was doing the nanny stuff, I was thinking, and obviously this whole time everyone was like, do fashion. But then with fashion, they're like, do fashion. But then they're like, oh, but there's no money in it until you do advertising. But to do advertising, you have to do editorial. Mm. I was like, I don't want to do editorial. I don't want to do anything. Like, I didn't want to do any of it.
Yeah.
So I did art direction instead for the film industry. So I switched kind of industries a little bit. And I worked in as an art director. So that's like buying the props, dressing the set, doing all that, never touching a camera. That was perfect for me. But again, the money was shit. It was like, hi, can you dress this whole set for us for like £100? It was just like, no, this is not going to work out. Mm. So I stopped doing that as well. And now, I don't know. I'm making money from my work, which is great.
Right.
But people are still in my ear being like, do fashion, do this, do that, do this. Da, da, da. And I'm just like, I don't know.
Mm. I mean, given the amount of fairly widespread coverage you've had in the media with the Joyce work, I guess, you know, selling prints is going to be an obvious option for you.
Yeah.
But also you're selling, you've got a very unpretentious kind of, generally that theme has, I think, emerged, but you've got, you're selling sort of posters, I think you call them,
yep.
Which is kind of 50 quid a pop on your website.
Yep.
And that's very sort of, that's an incredibly kind of down to earth thing for you to do. Because a lot of artists are really kind of like, you know, that whole thing of editioned prints and they cost £2,000 a pop. And that's all cool.
But it's not accessible.
Yeah.
Well, that is still a thing. I'm like, part of me is like, oh, I'm going to close that poster shop right now. I'm not 100% about it because no one knows. I get a different opinion every day. They're like, some people are like, it's fine. Who cares? Like, do your limited edition stuff, do your posters. You know, the only people that buy my limited edition works are like rich white men. That is it. Like, and is that the only people I want to enjoy my work? Whereas the people that buy the posters, I can see who buys them, and it's like 70% young women, young men in their like 20s to 30s. They're not going to buy a big £2,000 print and put it in their house that they rent, that they can't afford the rent to even. So yeah, I guess it is nice. But then I do have people being like, it's gonna ruin your career when Sotheby's have your sales, because it's gonna sort of fuck everything up. Oh my god, devalue your brand. And that kind of shit gives me nightmares, and I just don't know. But I don't know. Who knows? We'll see. But another part of me just thinks, who cares? When I'm dead and this fucks up my auction, I don't care. Sorry, guys. No money for you. I'm dead.
Well, but you need an agent or someone who can just take care of that shit for you.
I have them. And they change their opinion every day as well. Right, everyone. Right. So everyone even they has don't really.
Yeah, that's the thing. And nobody knows anything. Well, that's what pisses me off.
Yeah, the thing that I've learned is that I don't know everything, as you can tell from the way I'm talking. I do things my way and that's it. But what I found quite scary is there's all these adults who are like telling me what to do, but I can convince them to change their mind. So I go in there and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm doing posters. And they're like, no, you can't do posters because of this, this, this. And I learned in art history that you can't do posters for this reason and that reason. And then I start explaining to them how much money it makes or like how I'm doing it. I break it down to them and they're like, I kind of want to start selling posters now. And you're like, what the fuck? Like, how are you changing your mind? Like, you're supposed to be stoic and like, tell me what to do. But I can convince you that it's okay. No one knows.
You realize that I don't know? You're supposed to know more than I do.
You're supposed to know and you don't know. And so, yeah. So that's why I'm just going to do whatever I want because no one knows.
Yeah. Well, your job is to just do the work, right?
Well, yeah, that's the other thing. Someone told me that it was Laura that told me that. She was like, who cares if it fucks up your work? This isn't the only work you're going to have. Carry on making work.
Mm.
So it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. Can you really never see yourself pointing the camera, you know, away from you and taking pictures of other people? Because you have said there's something about taking pictures of other people. I think you've already really kind of answered that question, but there's something you find uncomfortable about the idea of it. I think you refer to it as a responsibility.
Yeah.
Which I suppose it is, but why is it so onerous to you, that responsibility?
I think it's personal and it's political. I think personally, it's a shyness thing. So I might come across as confident, but inside I'm like, I'm like half shy, half loud. I'm shy polar, I would say.
Oh my God, like, you just coined a new phrase.
Shy polar, you'll see it tomorrow on the web. I'm like half shy, half confident. So going to places like the honeymoon suite, half of me is like, yeah, crazy life. And half is like, I want to die right now. So what were we just saying?
About photographing other people.
Yeah. So half of it is just a confidence thing. I just don't feel confident. And I was chatting to a friend the other day who's a director, and she's my age and she's a director, and she was telling me about doing auditions. And I was like, how do you feel comfortable letting people audition in front of you? And she was like, listen, the first person that came in, I was like, oh my God, are you okay? Is everything okay? Can I get you any water? Can I get you anything? Oh my God, okay, we're ready when you are. And she said, by the end of the day, you're like, fucking come on, give me your spit, like give me the thing, get out. And so I know that if I did it, I'd get into it.
Yeah.
But then that scares me as well, because I do think morally, taking pictures of other people, especially women, I just think there's a long history, and I think you can't just be like, no, I'm a woman and I'm just doing what I want and it's fine. I think there is a history, there is a responsibility, and it's just something that I'd rather just not do it, just so I don't have to write about it. Like, if I was doing interviews and they were like, why do you take pictures of, like, I've seen it happen to other photographers, and when they can't back themselves up, it's so embarrassing. Like, for instance, there's a lot of white photographers that only exclusively photograph black people, and you'll ask them about it and they will literally deny it and be like, no, I just am interested in like the music or the culture, or no, it's not that. And it's like, just fucking own up to it and just say why you do it. And I think there's a lot of photographers that are just not facing up to what they're doing, and that they are profiting from it, and that they are getting more out of it than the model does sometimes, and I'm just not cool with that.
Yeah. But I think the fact that you're so kind of, you know, aware of those issues would make it a very interesting
I'd probably be
proposition.
Okay. No, I wouldn't be the way. I'd be fine. But I'm not ready.
No. You've got plenty of time. Plenty of time.
And this is working out for now.
No, of course. Yeah. And so Joyce is an ongoing thing.
Ongoing.
What's the next thing for her? If I may call her again.
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't plan that bit.
There's nothing.
The only thing I plan is to be technically better each time.
Yeah, I was going to say, you are, everything is very meticulous. I must say, are you a very meticulous person?
I am.
Mm. It shows, because I mean, you know, you go back to those ones, the early ones when she's sitting at the desk and all the props are incredibly carefully chosen. Everything looks really, you know, extremely pucker.
Thanks.
You know, like the, you know, it doesn't look,
as they say.
Like, I think, you know, you've almost suggested that you just kind of grab a costume. But
I
bought something on eBay. And maybe you do buy things on eBay, but they're chosen carefully.
Yeah, there's a mix between careful and careless, I guess. Mm. Yeah. But no, it is very careful. Maybe I am just being...
And technically, it's all very... Yeah. How are you lighting this stuff when you've got mirrors everywhere?
Not very well. Like, I think that's why I'm like, oh yeah, it's all just a bit of a mess. But to other people, it looks really considered. It's because it's trial and error for me. I've never used a light meter. I don't take lights with me. I just set the camera up and just twist things around and press things until it looks good. And if I had an assistant, they'd be like, what are you doing? Oh my God. Like, or even my dad, he's like, what are you doing? Or he's like, check the white balance. I'm like, what the fuck is the white balance? I don't know. Or like, get the gray card. I don't need any of that stuff. But so that's why I feel inadequate, but it comes across as very adequate.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean,
it
works. Thanks. For you.
Yeah, it works for now.
Are there any other photographers that you have recently come across that you could tell us about that other people can check out?
Oh my God.
Do you buy photo books, by the way?
No, can we talk about this?
Yeah, we can.
Because I don't buy photo books. I don't go to a lot of exhibitions.
Mm.
And I don't research other photographers. And I feel, I'm confessing that, like a little sinner.
Why do you feel guilty?
I feel bad.
You feel guilty?
Because... No, because it sounds arrogant. Like, I don't look at anything. I just do me. Like, I hate people that are like that. That are like, there's a lot of people that say, like, don't look at anything. Just stay in your bubble. Mm. And I think that's bullshit. Like, look at other stuff. Do whatever you want. But I think there's a thing that happened where when I was aspiring, when I was like, oh my God, I want to be a photographer. And when you're at school and you had to do like case studies on other photographers, that's when I could give you like an encyclopedia of photographers. I could talk all day about other people. Mm. But it's so weird how as soon as you start becoming successful yourself, I don't look at anything now. I don't, because it's just competition. That's it. I just see competition, or I see, or you know them, you know that who they are now, and you're like, oh, yeah. I know that. I know her now. I know him.
Yeah, yeah. But he's that's it, isn't it? You can become aware of people and then kind of file that away.
Yeah.
But then ultimately, you've got to do your own thing.
I do have to force myself to get back into it and like look at stuff and be excited about stuff again. So, and yeah, buying book like when I go to, so I go to a lot of the festivals and fairs in photography, and I just can't, like, people are like breaking their arms carrying all these books they've got, and they're like, oh, I can't wait to take these home, and I'm like, why don't I have that?
Not everyone does. I mean, and maybe that's why you're original to some extent. I mean, of course, you know, there's a long tradition of people photographing themselves, especially women.
Yeah.
Cindy Sherman and all those people we talked about. But I guess, you know, you are very much dealing with ideas. And in fact, in some ways, I mean, do you think of yourself as a photographer, or do you think of yourself as an artist who uses photography?
Yeah, I think more of that.
The artist who uses photography. Because that is quite often, I just burped
into your microphone.
It's fine. As long as you don't mind everyone.
Hi, everyone.
All the small voice listeners hearing
it.
Coffee. Yeah. That's fine. Wake you up. No one's going to judge you for it. Yeah. Yeah, that is quite often an excuse for
being bad.
Taking shit pictures. Yeah.
It's like, I'm a fine art photographer.
Yeah, I don't care about
I'm a video maker, not a filmmaker.
It's really just another way of saying my pictures are shit.
Yeah,
part of my
process.
Please
don't hire me. Please don't test me.
But you're in a weird kind of, and again, this is that thing of putting people in pigeonhole, you know, in pigeonholes. But I just think there's a kind of natural human instinct for us to do that, because we have to kind of get your head around where someone, what space someone occupies. Yeah. But you're quite difficult, I think, to kind of pigeonhole, because you are very, yeah, exactly. Because you are. Like, clearly you've got the technical, even if you don't see it as kind of understanding that, you know, you've got the ability to make the images look awesome, and you're working with ideas. So I don't know. That is a total cul-de-sac.
I think people are like, you should, like, there's so much stuff that is like obvious that I should be doing. They're like, you're not shit at this. You should do this. But there's just a part of me that just likes to just bunk off and do the things I'm supposed to do.
But, you know, the world is full of people telling you what you should do, right? So ultimately, your job is to do what the hell you want to do.
Exactly.
And that's you know, as someone who creates art. Mm. What's the most important thing about being a photographer that you've learned about yourself?
Oh, the most important thing about being a photographer that I've learned about myself?
Yeah. Does that make sense?
No, let's break down that question.
Let me start again. I'll edit this out.
You should put this in.
What's the most important thing you've learned about yourself by being a photographer?
Yes.
Does that make more sense
now? That makes total sense.
Okay, Jesus.
The most important, well, I've learned a lot, but I don't know what's important.
I mean,
what is important?
I guess it's good to know that you can get on a plane and go to
Pennsylvania. Self-sufficiency and confidence. Yeah. We're going to get so Gok Wang here, but it's all about the confidence. I've learned to be confident. I think it tests your comfort zone. So apparently your comfort zone is that every time you do something you're scared of, it opens it up a bit more. So my comfort zone is flapping in the wind right now, because I've done all the things that I've been terrified of, like social anxiety, like traveling alone, all those things. I hate it, but now I can do any of it. I feel, and also I can chat to anyone now. I used to be scared of talking to asking for like, oh, hi, can I have 10 camels, please? And now I'm like, yeah, hey.
Yeah, I mean, because there's that kind of awkwardness that you had to deal with, especially going to the love hotel and being on your own.
Everyone staring at you. Mm. It's like, that's what they do to people with social anxiety. They make them like put a sausage on a string and take it for a walk, because that's how you're supposed to beat it. Do something really absurd.
Right.
And it works, because you're like, the world didn't end.
Right.
No one pointed at me. No one screamed. Like, no one cares.
And is that the thing of, you know, people say you have to get comfortable being uncomfortable, you know, which it kind of applies to everything, I think.
Yeah.
But certainly, as a photographer,
yeah,
you know, you are in uncomfortable situations a lot. You know, it's a very uncomfortable thing at times. You know, what advice would you give your 20-year-old self?
Then? Oh my lord, you took it there. 20.
Yeah.
What was I doing? I think I'd just gone to Leeds College of Art to start a photography degree, and I had chosen the degree based on how many of my friends were going to be living in the same city. So that was a mistake. So I'd tell myself, no, do you know what? What are you supposed to tell yourself something like an instruction, like get out of there, do this, do that?
Advice.
Or can I just give myself a little kiss on the cheek and be like, you're doing fine.
I think that is a perfect.
Yeah, that's what I would do. I'd be like,
answer.
Yeah, I'd give myself a little kiss and be like, have fun. Yeah. See you later. Because I think I went a really crazy route. Like I said, every photography course I was on hated me. They were like, get out, we hate you. Until finally I went to LCC and they finally accepted me. So, but I wouldn't have it any other way, is what I'm trying to say. But no, I think I did the right thing.
Absolutely. Well, no, yeah, regrets. Because all those experiences, you know, are ultimately all coming, you know, come into play.
But maybe don't, I'm happy. I'm all good.
Are you a pretty optimistic person?
No.
Really?
No.
But don't you think the future's bright?
In terms of my career, no, I feel like I'm quite realistic about it. I'm like, what I've learned so far is that in my head, it feels like you do one amazing project and your head is so buried in that project that when it's released and published and you get all the acclaim, you think that's it, I'm done. And then you're like, I have to do it again and again and again. And I realized you just have to keep climaxing till you die, and that's quite a statement, isn't it? Like that's I don't know, does that sound fun or does that sound horrible? Sounds weird. So yeah, you have to keep bringing yourself to this peak, like, wow, she did it again, like, well done, like, she's returned. So you've got to keep doing it. It reminds me a lot of like people's music careers, like you've just got to keep pumping out albums and keep having the enthusiasm and love for it. So I'm quite realistic about it. I'm like, it's just hard work. It's not, and it can easily slip away, like when I had that year of not making any work. So it's like, I know you just have to stay on track.
Absolutely.
It's like training.
It's a practice. Yeah. And it's just kind of
so I'm not like, oh, daily struggle. But I'm also, but I do have that optimistic bit where I've had so many nice surprises that I really didn't see coming that I'm like, yeah, that's definitely going to happen again. And they're just going to get more exciting. So yeah.
I have no doubt. Yeah. Well, thanks for chatting. It's been great fun. I've enjoyed it
a
lot.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Gina.